Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you again for joining me as we talk about some classic cardboard and some classic stories about one particular classic person. I'll give you more details about that in a moment. But if you recall a few episodes ago, I did a look back at the 1970 Topps set and did some comparing of apples to apples with the 2019 Topps Heritage set. And it was one of those shows that was a concept behind the show that I thought, well, why didn't I do this before? You know, I've been doing this podcast since 2016. You'd think that I would have done that type of a show for the previous three releases of Topps Heritage and compared them, respectfully to 1967, 68, and 69 Topps. But I didn't do it. And this week's show is the exact opposite of it. It's where a really good idea came to mind, and I just kind of blurted it out and said, I'm going to do this. But then when it came to the actual execution of it, I probably should have thought it through a little better. If you listened to our show last week, you heard me mention that my father, Kevin Salmon, passed away a few weeks ago, back on May 15th. And with the timing of Father's Day being next Sunday, I figured, you know, this would actually be kind of a neat way to not only honor my father, but also to discuss, you know, parents' involvement, and in particular, a father's involvement with baseball cards or baseball or sports in general. So, you know, during the show, I had mentioned that my dad passed, and I said, you know what? We're going to do a Father's Day show, and it's going to be a special show because I'm going to go through my collection. I'm going to pull out all the Brooklyn Dodger cards that I have because my dad grew up in Brooklyn. He was a Dodger fan, and we'll look back at a few great Brooklyn Dodgers and talk about my dad and tie it into Father's Day. Again, great idea. I just blurted it out as I'm recording the show. It just comes out, and I'm thinking to myself, you know what, Matt? Hell of an idea. Let's do it. And then came the part where I actually went through my collection. And even though I have a box full of late 40s and early 50s cards that I have purchased at various shows or have gotten online over the last year or so, while I thought of the, 100, 150 cards that fall into that late 40s, early 50s category, while I thought there had to be some Brooklyn Dodgers cards in there, the truth is, I didn't have a single Brooklyn Dodger card, and I have no idea how that happened. Again, going through these boxes and these binders and, you know, picking lots of cards from various shops online and, you know, brick and mortar buildings, somehow I just managed not to get a Brooklyn Dodger card. That's kind of impossible to do. Now, granted, most Brooklyn Dodger cards from the early to mid-50s and late 40s, well, they feature star players. You're talking Duke Snider and Jackie Robinson and Sandy Koufax and Roy Campanella and you name it. But there are some, I wouldn't even call them common cards, but there are some players. You can get your Joe Black. You can get your Clem Labine, your Carl Erskine cards. You can get them relatively cheap. Maybe you can find a Walter Alston card somewhere or a Leo DeRocher, however far back you want to go. But somehow, through my various purchases, I didn't buy a single Brooklyn Dodger card. So at first I thought, well, that idea is shot. But then I thought, okay, no, you know what? Let me do this because I still want to do this Father's Day show and I still want to look back at some cards that, you know, I can think of some great stories with my dad and tie it into this whole topic here. And I went rummaging through the box of cards and I actually found five cards, including one that was already featured on this show and then four others that I had purchased over the last several months that, as soon as I looked at them, whether it was the player or the team or there was some other story behind it, as soon as I looked at them, I said, I can tell a story here. I can tell a story with this one. I can tell a story with that one. And I was able to cobble that together and tell these stories. So I'm looking forward to doing that. And let me tell you the five cards. In case you didn't see our video link that was posted yesterday on YouTube, all you have to do is type in Wax Ecstatic Father's Day Cards in the YouTube search, or look back on our timeline at Wax and Gum Stains, and you'll see the link. And I'll talk a little bit about the cards in that link there. But we start with the first card that was featured way back in March of 2017. That was our feature card in the episode number 70, which focused on 1957 Tops. And that is card number 30, Pee-wee Reese. And I'll go into a little bit of that. But Pee-wee Reese was obviously, you know, with the Brooklyn Dodgers and with the LA Dodgers for a little bit afterwards. And one of my dad's favorite players. So that was a natural. Okay. So the one Brooklyn Dodger card that I have, and I'm not talking like retro releases, you know, not the 53 Tops Archives cards that were released in 1991 Brooklyn Dodgers. I'm talking legitimate, you know, released back in the day cards. That's my one card featuring the Brooklyn Dodgers. But we're also going to take a look at a 1960 Tops Don Zimmer. We've got a 1965 Tops Willie Stargell. We've got, of course, a stinking manager card. Got to work one of those in, right? But no, this is a distinguished gentleman, not only in baseball as a manager, as a player, but also in my hometown of Tampa, Florida, a 51 Bowman Al Lopez, 1951 card number 295. And last but not least, we're going to take a look at the legendary 1972 Topps Nolan Ryan, card number 595. Legendary for a lot of the wrong reasons, but, you know, Nolan Ryan was a factor in my life and my dad's life, and we all intersected together, which is pretty neat. So we'll talk about that in just a little bit. And I do want to also, before we do our usual housekeeping at the beginning of the program, I do also want to let you know that while this is a very different show, and while you know, the focus is on some memories of my father and talking about just fatherhood and good role models for people, and perhaps some life lessons from me that I can share with you, I do want to let you know that this is not going to be an episode where it's just, you know, sad stories and tears and, oh, my dad has died and how am I going to go on? You know, this isn't the Oprah Winfrey show. For reasons that I'll get into, so far I'm handling the death of my father actually fairly well, all things considered. But I just want to let you know, because I know some of you are probably listening to this going, oh God, this is going to be one of those tearjerker shows. No, it's certainly not my intention, and I'm not trying to make anybody feel down. This is, you know, again, this is going to be uplifting. This is going to be just a little different from what we normally do. And different is a good thing. You do need to shake things up just a little bit every now and then. But also, you know, for me, this is catharsis. You are saving me a couple hundred dollars from going to the psychiatrist to hash this out here. So let's all lay down on the couch here and share some good stories. And I encourage you to share your stories, too, on our timeline at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, because I think there's a lot of good stories that people have and they can share. And this is one way that we can do it. Now, I mentioned Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, which is open 24/7. I did receive some condolences from listeners about my father's passing recently. Thank you very much for doing that. I really do appreciate it. And words really do mean a lot in times like this. I've given condolences to a lot of people for deaths in the family or you know, tragic long-term illnesses that get diagnosed. And when you're at the other end of it, it really does mean something. So thank you very much for those of you who did, you know, take a couple minutes to say sorry for the passing of my dad. I really do appreciate it. But on the fun side, we're talking baseball cards there, and the timeline is open for any conversation. You could talk about our shows, about the players we feature, the card sets we feature, just the hobby in general, the sport in general. You know, we take basically any 2 cents that come along, and you know, if there's a conversation that sprouts from it, then that's certainly great news. So it's open 24/7. Feel free to comment, share wax and gum stains with your friends on Twitter. Tell them about it. And that, of course, is where you'll see the first news about any video links or podcast links. They all come up through there. And we have a fun little, I don't want to call it a poll, just kind of a, almost like a poll question, if you will. I saw Topps is going to be doing in the 2020 base set, they're going to be honoring the best sets from each decade. And with Topps starting their sets in 1951, so essentially the beginning of the 1950s, they asked, or Cardboard Connection, excuse me, Cardboard Connection asked, which is the best top set from each decade. So I just retweeted it out there and retweeted it again, I think yesterday. And basically, you know, just want to ask you, I'm curious what your answers are. And we've gotten some great responses so far regarding the best top sets of the decades. And in fact, there was one response that was almost dead on to what I would select. So I've got to say, some of you are definitely in tune to what I'm doing, and I, of course, will take all credit for it. But thank you anyways. Let's see, who was it? It was Suspicious Cat. That's a great handle, by the way. 1957, 1965, 1971, 1987, 1991. And only one for the 2000s here, 2010. But I can tell you, while I can certainly debate a lot of these, Suspicious Cat, certainly the first five I'm very much in agreement on. And again, I might change my mind. I may look back at a couple of these and go, well, you know, I like 1956 over 57. But yeah, I can't really argue with the first five there. P.K. Steinberg adding in 1956. 1961, 1974, 1987, 1993, and then he's got 2009 and 2011. And certainly with the older sets, again, you can't really argue with those. I was never a huge fan of 61 tops, but you know, you could argue 56 or 57. In the 70s, you could say 71 or 74, and we see some agreement on 1987. Let's see, Robbie T86, also known by the great name Booby Maine, 58, 65, 76, 83, 91, 2005, and 2012. I actually like 2005. I think that was the year that I kind of got sucked back into buying cards. But, you know, going back to the 1958, you know, you could make very good arguments that 56 or 57 or 58 is the best card from that decade. 76, same thing. You know, I like 71, but I also really love 76. And then you look at 74 and you go, that's pretty good as well. So some great suggestions there. Also, lastly, Doug McCready, 54, 62, 71, 87. The rest I closed my eyes and picked. you can definitely make a good case, anything beyond the junk wax era. If you're not a huge fan of it, you can just kind of throw a dart at it and see what sticks. But, you know, we see some similarities, 87 mentioned again, 71 mentioned again, but also 62. So you could argue 61, 62, or 65. 54 is a great choice, Doug. And again, you can argue 54, 56, 57, 58. What I found interesting in the early voting, if you will, is nobody said 52 or 53. Maybe because it's cliche. You know, you're expected to say 52 because of the mantle, or 53 because of that legendary design. But, you know, some great suggestions here from our listeners. So, again, if you would like to offer up your opinion on the best set from each decade for Topps, you can do it at our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. Wax Ecstatic does come your way every 2 weeks here via Audio Boom, our home base, and all the other various platforms and channels, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, Spotify, and many other platforms that grab the RSS feed and follow us. So if you could please, no matter how you listen, if your listening preference offers you the opportunity to rate the show and comment on it, please do, and please be honest, although we certainly accept all positive comments because that helps push Wax Ecstatic up the chain a little bit in the algorithm. the more positive votes and positive comments will expose the show a little bit more. And we're all for full frontal exposure on this program. So get the word out there that Wax Ecstatic happens every other Friday. It drops at noon Eastern, again, via Audio Boom and all the other channels. And of course, the links get posted at Wax and Gum Stains. Our next show will be on Friday, June 22nd. Now, that's one I'm going to have to pre-record well in advance because I will actually be doing a little work on my day job. And this is part of my day job that just absolutely sucks. I will be in Vancouver, British Columbia, getting ready for the 2019 NHL draft. So looking forward to going up to Vancouver. I've never been to Vancouver. I always love traveling to Canada, but I've never been to Vancouver, so I'm looking forward to that. Also, looking forward to a little time before and after the draft in Seattle. We're actually flying in and out of Seattle. But we're going to try to catch a Mariners game that's there. Unfortunately, not going to catch the Mariner game where they're dressing up as the Seattle Pilots. But I think we'll be watching from the SeaTac lounge as we'll be flying out late that Saturday night. But anyways, you know, looking forward to that. And, you know, like I said, going to a city in Vancouver that I've never been to and going to a city in Seattle that I have been to. But only in the middle of the night. It was during a crazy preseason road trip that I traveled with the Lightning. And let's see, we were actually playing the game in Everett, Washington, which is just north of Seattle. And we flew in from Regina, Saskatchewan. And yes, that's how you say it. Regina. Go ahead and get your giggles out. Regina. We flew in from the beautiful dot on the map in the middle of the Saskatchewan prairie known as Regina to Seattle Tacoma Airport, arrived about 1:15 in the morning, and with a travel party of 63 people, including a fine blend of American citizens, Canadians, Russians, Swedes, Finns, Czechs. Let's see, what other nationality did we have on there? Pretty much everybody. Naturally, SeaTac at 1:15 in the morning had one person at the customs counter. So my only memories of Seattle is sleeping on the team bus, opening up my eye long enough to see us pass the Space Needle, and then stumbling into the Holiday Inn in Everett, Washington at about 3 in the morning. So hopefully we'll have some more positive memories of our next visit. But the reason why I tell you that story is that we will be pre-recording the show a few days in advance, but it will still be released on Friday, June 22nd. So be on the lookout for that. And as always, we appreciate your cash donations to help keep Wax Ecstatic strong and growing. I do always like to dangle that threat that if we don't get any donations, I will spend one show opening up a cello pack or a rack pack of 89 Bowman. So if you don't want the 89 Bowman treatment, make your donations at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. All donations go right back into the show, either the maintenance of our website and the archive, which is hosted by Audio Boom. There is a cost to doing that every year. And then on top of that, the purchases of the cards. So when we go out to card shows, when we make a purchase on eBay or a local card shop, the money that you're donating goes right into the product that we discuss on this show. And then if we have excess product, for example, if I open up a box of cards for a particular show, whatever is left over, we put them to donations to Kidorty Cards or Cards for Kids, to nonprofit organizations that help dispense cards, both old and new, to children. For Commons for Kids, it's through charitable donations. Through Kidorty Cards, it's through a monthly subscription where you pick the team that you want a monthly package of cards, and they take all these donated cards and put together little team packs for kids. And it's a great cause to not only find a good use for the cards that are spilling over in your collection, but also to continue to grow the hobby, to put the piece of cardboard in kids' hands. It's not online. It's not virtual. It's the real deal. They're holding on to it. They're flipping it over. They're reading it. They're sticking push pins through it, whatever. But, you know, it's putting cards in the hands of kids, and it also helps put more energy into the sport. You know, keeps young people paying attention to baseball in particular, but really any sport. And that is always a good thing. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the old man. Yep, my dad, Kevin Salmon, passed away on May 15th. Sudden and apparently massive heart attack. And my dad was 76 years old. Amazingly went 76 years in his life without a major health issue. He started having some heart problems about 6 months ago. But, you know, we all thought that, you know, pacemaker gets put in, a couple doctor's visits, adjustments in medication, this tracking device, that tracking device, you know, all this other, you know, stuff that the medical industry, you know, sticks on you or in you would help things out. But, you know, 76 years of, I'll be honest, mostly bad habits. You know, he was a smoker for 60 years. He was overweight for much of the past, I'd say 40 years, under a lot of stress, a lot of pressure, was diabetic, you know, and obviously as you get older, you're slowing down, so you're not as active. So a lot of that culminates into, you know, a tough physical condition to be in. And that's why I say I'm amazed it took 76 years for something in the form of an irregular heartbeat to raise red flags. And that also doesn't surprise me that it was ultimately a heart attack that ended his life. That is something that you kind of know in the back of your mind. Okay, you know, dad hasn't taken care of himself too much. He's starting to have heart issues. This could happen someday. And it's kind of a morbid thought, but it's human too. You naturally think that it may happen. And lo and behold, it happened at his house. My mother was at the house too. And, you know, long story short, he wasn't able to be revived. Basically, you know, was officially dead at the hospital. But as far as I'm concerned, from what I heard from the stories, sounds like basically he just collapsed in his chair and was probably dead as soon as he hit the chair. So we find some comfort in knowing that he died in a place that he would want to be. It was at his house. It was on his back patio. It was in the company of his two best companions, the dogs. And that's not to slight my mother, but you know, they call a dog a man's best friend for a reason. But, you know, also in the company of my mother, you know, this is, and it sounds strange, but my dad never, ever would have wanted to die in a nursing home, you know, some building that smells like pee, and 98% of the residents hate the fact that they're alive and still living there. My dad never would have wanted to die hooked up to a ventilator or some other contraption with the family holding hands, standing around the bed going, okay, do we pull the plug today? So dad got his wish in the sense that, you know, not that you want to pick how you die, but he got his wish in the sense that it was in a place that he was most comfortable at. And also, from what I know, doing what he wanted to do, and that was just stay busy, stay active. He was going to, you know, go clean the pool, and that's when the heart attack fell him. So, you know, it was sudden. Like I said, even though you know in the back of your mind that it could happen, it's hard to believe that it happened. It's hard to believe, you know, this Father's Day, you know, I can't send a Father's Day card to him. I can't call him up. I can't have my kids talk to him. And, you know, we're actually, you know, my family's going to be on vacation that weekend. And we had planned this vacation before he passed away. But part of the original plan was, because we're going to be going out to the east coast of Florida for a couple of days. Part of the original plan was, well, we're going to leave the hotel early enough Sunday to swing by mom and dad's house on the way back home and hang around there, maybe eat dinner, you know, let the kids see, you know, mom and dad. And, you know, that's not part of the plan anymore. And, you know, that sucks. And Father's Day is going to be a little odd for me. And likewise, and if you've ever had a tragedy in your life, if you've ever had a sibling or a parent or a good friend pass, you know that the first year is always the toughest. So Father's Day is going to be tough. my parents' wedding anniversary. This would have been their 50th. Okay, so as if it wasn't tough enough, now you're talking about the golden anniversary. Oh, they fell just shy of it. You know, that's going to be tough. Dad's birthday, Thanksgiving, Christmas. Those are going to be tough, especially Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving's always been my favorite holiday. Always in the sense, since I was a teenager, I'd say. Let's be honest, when I was a kid, it was Christmas. But, Thanksgiving was always my favorite, at least as an adult, because it meant getting family together. And getting family together was a big thing for my dad, and cooking a turkey and cooking the ham and all the side dishes and just having everybody over for a few hours and, you know, shooting the breeze and having a beer and, you know, watching a football game. That was dad. And that's, you know, one of the that's going to be a tough one. And, you know, we're going to have to pull out all the stops to make it entertaining and not depressing. So, a lot of changes, a lot of tough things that are up ahead for us. But, you know, at the same time, like I said, I'm handling it fairly well because of two reasons. And one is my faith. I'm a Christian. My dad was a Christian. He was Catholic. I'm Episcopalian. I left the Catholic Church a while back. But anyways, you know, we believe that the death is not the end. It's the beginning, and it's the beginning of life eternal. So through faith, I believe that I'll see him again at some point in time. And, for my sake and my family's sake, I hope that's a very long time from now. But when that time comes, you know, I'll see him again. So that's one thing that helps you get through the daily ups and downs. The other thing is, and this is a nice little life's lesson that I want to get out now. I was thinking of pushing this back to, you know, the end of the podcast, kind of a moral of the story. But I want to get this out there now. A big, big, big reason why I've been able to pick up the pieces and move forward. And this isn't to say that I'm in a great mood all the time, or I'm happy-go-lucky, or I'm glad that he's gone, or anything like that, because there's still mourning. There's still sadness. There's still, you know, it's a different world without him. But one of the big reasons why I'm able to pick up the pieces and move on a little better than other people in this situation is I had a great relationship with my father. Now, that's not to say it was perfect. I had my run-ins just like any other person will have with their parents. But for the most part, I had a great relationship with my father. And I think the bigger part is I have no regrets. No boxes were unchecked. No stones weren't overturned. You know, it's as complete of a relationship and a life with one another that we could have had. Like I said, you know, you had your run-ins, typically, you know, as a teenager, and that's what teenagers do with their parents. But compared to most teenagers, you know, I didn't completely alienate myself, you know, from my parents. You know, there was still a respect there, but, you know, you still got along just fine, even though you had your run-ins every now and then. So, you know, other than maybe two or three years of just that awkward teenager stage where you're going head to head with your parents at various times, I, didn't really have that. That wasn't as big of an issue for me. So, with that in mind, that's one of the big reasons why I'm able to move forward is that we had a great relationship. We got along well. We understood each other well. We were both proud of each other's accomplishments. I'm married, got two kids. We were very involved in mom and dad's, you know, lives. So, you know, if not once a month, then every few weeks, we'd either be over at their house or they'd be over at our house for a few hours. Like I said, the kids would call on birthdays or Father's Day or Mother's Day. The holidays were always important somehow, some way. We would get the family together. Easter, Christmas, Thanksgiving, even, you know, patriotic holidays or national holidays like Labor Day or Memorial Day, somehow, some way we'd find ourselves getting together. And, you know, that's a big thing, is that we valued the time together that we had, and we made the best of it. We made the most of it. So there were no grudges. There was nothing held back. There was nothing, like I said, no boxes were unchecked. And I know not everybody is as fortunate as I am to be in that situation there. So that has helped me out a lot. But again, this leads to the lesson here, and that is, if your parents are still alive, and I know the focus is mostly on dad here, but if your parents are still alive, make sure that there are no boxes unchecked. Make sure there are no grudges, because I've seen it firsthand. When the time comes, you can't make it up. You can't turn back the hands of time and change something. So when you have that availability to do something with your parents, you need to do it. And you need to do it for the right reasons and the best of intentions. And even if it's as simple as just giving them a call, or even an email, you know, a call is certainly more personal. But even if you just send an email and say, hey, you know, I was thinking about you. How's it going? When can I give you a call? That goes a long way. It really does. Now, if your parents aren't alive anymore, or maybe you have a really good reason not to be in contact with them. For example, maybe your father was abusive or a raging alcoholic or a criminal, whatever the case may be. Maybe your father left your mother when you were 2 years old and was never a part of your life. That I understand. You know, it's very hard to jump over that bridge to reach out and make that connection. That's ultimately up to you. But if your parents have passed and you can't have that relationship every day and you can't check all the boxes and you can't, you know, bury the hatchet, you know, like somebody whose parents are alive now, then what you can do, because you can't go back in time, you can't make up for lost time, you can't right the wrongs in the past when the other party is not there, what you can do is make choices in your life, make the right decisions to help other people get along in their life. So, you know, maybe your dad wasn't around for your Little League games. Well, if you've got a child who's in Little League and you've got the availability, you've got the time to do it, you know, be a coach or show up at every game, show up at every practice, show support for your child. Likewise in school, you know, maybe your dad didn't help you with your homework, or you really struggled because, you know, he looked down on you for whatever reason. Well, help your kids with classwork, help other students achieve in education, because the world is getting dumber. So yeah, any way we can educate the next generation and the generation after that and the generation after that is definitely a good thing. You know, the short story is, or the short moral of the story is that you have the choice, you have the opportunity. Even though you can't go back and change things to make relationships with your parents any better, you have the opportunity now to make relationships with the people you know now stronger and better and more positive. So whether it's with your kids or your family or with, you know, other friends or coworkers, I guess, you know, the big thing I'm getting down to is you have the choice to be a good person, a good role model, a positive impact, a light in a very dark world. And you have that opportunity, if you choose to accept it, to basically just be good and do good and show other people how to be good and do good. Because you may be on Twitter right now going through wax and gum stains, and you're seeing all the other comments that are coming in and all the other news stories that are coming in. And it's a dark world out there. And I believe it was Eleanor Roosevelt who said something, and I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, better to be a light in a dark world. So you have that choice to be a light. and it may not necessarily make up for any shortcomings in your relationships with your parents who have since passed, or like I said, are completely removed from your life for one reason or another. But you do have the opportunity to be a positive influence, to be an inspiration, to lead others to good things and be good people. And this world needs good things to happen from good people led by good leaders. We're short on a lot of those things right now. So those are the morals that I wanted to pass along before I get into some of these cards and some of these particular stories. It's, you know, again, you know, I'm able to move forward because of my faith, but also my great relationship with my dad. Again, if your folks are alive, be involved in their lives because you don't know when it's going to happen. If your folks have passed on or you're separated from them for whatever reason, even if you can't have that great relationship with them, that's not stopping you if you wish to have great relationships with other people and to show them the way. And I will wrap up this moral thought of the show with a thought from a late great friend of mine, Chris Thomas. I've mentioned him on this show before. He was a local radio talk show host, TV sports anchor. I used to produce his radio show many, many years ago. And he would end every show with the phrase, "Tell someone you love them, and mean it, for tomorrow is not guaranteed." And that is so true. And we lost Chris 15 years ago due to pancreatic cancer. It was a very quick, aggressive cancer. Basically, from the time it was diagnosed to the time he died, it was about 6 months' time. So, you know, it was never more evident, you know, in that situation that you just never know. So tell someone you love them, be a part of their lives, and make sure when they're alive, when you're alive, the boxes get checked. And you're not looking at that checklist afterwards going, shoulda, woulda, coulda. So some inspirational thoughts there. Again, I thank you for getting through this moral portion of the program. Again, this is not normal, but this is a special circumstance show. And you saved me a couple hundred dollars with a psychiatrist. I think I may have saved you a couple hundred dollars with a psychiatrist. So we're kind of working together on this. But, you know, I know on Turner Classic Movies on Father's Day, they're going to show Field of Dreams. And if you haven't seen Field of Dreams, I don't know how you haven't, because it's everywhere. And if you're a baseball fan, you've probably seen it. But spoiler here, if you haven't, you know, the final scene where Ray Kinsella is playing catch with his dad, and it's a tear-jerking scene. Even more so, you know, I watched it after my dad passed away. And oh yeah, there was some crying there. But even though I can't play catch with my dad anymore, I found peace in that, you know, I didn't have that grudge factor where the Ray Kinsella character, you know, didn't have any kind of relationship with his father for decades until he passed. And, you know, this was kind of making up for lost time. So, hey, I can't play catch with my dad, but you know what? I can play catch with my son. I can play catch with my kids. I can play catch as a coach. I can, you know, be a leader and a de facto parent to other people, you know, by being a good person and by caring and by doing the things that, you know, a father and son do, doing those things to an extended audience. So, you know, as wonderful of a movie as Field of Dreams is, you can't turn back the hands of time. You can't pull in the 1919 White Sox in your cornfield. You know, you can't bring your dad back to get that one last game of catch there. But you do have the choices to do it through other means and you know, do good things with good people. So there we go with our morals in this week's podcast. It is something that we normally don't do, but again, given the circumstances, I felt worthy of sharing those ideas now, as opposed to waiting until the very end of the podcast. Now, we are getting a little closer to the end of the podcast, so I want to get to these five particular cards Again, it started with a good idea of I'm going to pull together all of my Brooklyn Dodger cards and tell stories remembering my dad and, you know, the tie-in between fathers and son, and especially through baseball. You get it through other sports, but especially baseball. And again, going through my cards, I realized, oh, I don't have any Brooklyn Dodger cards, except for one. And that is the 57 Topps Pee Wee Reese card, card number 30. We featured it back on episode 70 back in March of 2017. And I'd encourage you to go back to that episode in the archives if you want the full story. But the big reason why I selected this card of the five that we're going to look at is not only because it is actually the only Brooklyn Dodger card I have right now, but you know, as I stated in that episode, this was a great link in history, not just to 1957 and not just to the Brooklyn Dodgers, but also to my father. And, you know, I'm glad I recognized that 2.5 years ago and, you know, really appreciate it now. There's a lot of love for the Brooklyn Dodgers. There's a lot of fuzzy memories about the Brooklyn Dodgers. People forget that the reason why the Dodgers left for Los Angeles, there are many reasons why, but one is Ebbets Field, as much as we build it up to be this magical castle of a ballpark, you know, Ebbets Field was getting close to 50 years old. It was not well maintained. It took a beating in the winter in Brooklyn. You know, it was wedged into a city block, which, of course, was part of its charm and character. But, you know, as you're going into the late 1950s and you're going into a very modern industrial age, almost space age time period in America, having this cheery old relic from 1912 or 1911, somewhere around there when Ebbets Field was open, that was not very charming. You know, this was before the destruction of the original Penn Station in New York. So this is way before you had heritage groups, people who would save old buildings or even the facades of old buildings from destruction, from just being knocked down. The old Pennsylvania Station was knocked down for what is the new Madison Square Garden, which is built on top of Penn Station. But, you know, before the days of saving architectural wonders from the past, you just took a wrecking ball to it. And Ebbets Field by the mid-1950s was just an old dump of a ballpark. And then there, of course, was gold in them hills of California. There were numerous threats for teams to move out to California in the 1950s. Bill Veeck, the best example I can think of, he wanted to purchase the Athletics from Philadelphia, move them out there. He wanted to perhaps move the St. Louis Browns out to Los Angeles, and Major League Baseball got in his way because they didn't like him. And, you know, it was the Dodgers who were able to take that opportunity. And it was Walter O'Malley who talked Horace Stoneham, the owner of the Giants, into moving out to California together, because Stoneham was in the same situation. The Polo Grounds was a dump. He wanted something that was modern, not something that was built pre-World War I. He had that built in Minneapolis, the old Metropolitan Stadium, where the Giants minor league affiliate, the Millers, were playing. You know, we were just a few weeks away from the Minneapolis or the Minnesota Giants. Instead, they move out to San Francisco. The Dodgers move out to L.A., and that's that. But, you know, the stories that I tell there, you know, a lot of people forget about the facts that, you know, the Dodgers and Giants were playing in old crumbling stadiums. They were always going to be in the shadow of the Yankees, who were in a very dominant position once again at that time. And also New York City was changing. New York City was becoming decrepit. And while a lot of people look back in time, especially the 1940s or 50s, you have these fond memories of New York City. But as we all know, New York City would be on a decline through the 1960s, especially the 70s, and then finally started cleaning up under Ed Koch and later Rudy Giuliani in the 80s and 90s. And now New York is, you know, still has its rough parts, but certainly is much more tourist friendly than it was, say, 35, 40 years ago. So, you know, we all have these fuzzy memories of how great Brooklyn was and how great Ebbets Field was, and how you'd never have a professional baseball team in Brooklyn again. And even though the NBA's Nets are there, and yes, there's a basketball presence in Brooklyn, we all know the Nets are there because it's a shiny new building. They get to claim, you know, their, you know, acreage in Brooklyn. It's really more of a push for the, you know, the new yuppies, if you will, the up and comers who have turned Brooklyn from an industrial borough into, you know, a millennial mecca, if you will. So, you know, a lot of people yearn for the days of the Brooklyn Dodgers because you're not going to have a team like the Brooklyn Dodgers. You're not going to have a ballpark like Ebbets Field as much as you try to recreate it. And certainly plenty of teams have done that. So, you know, a lot of people yearn for the days of a baseball team that hasn't taken the field in over 60 years. So while there's a lot of reproduced Brooklyn Dodgers shirts and hats and jerseys and pennants and cards and you name it, there's a big script B or you know, there's an Ebbets Field somewhere, this one particular card is my one link to this moment, this team, this time in baseball history. And I absolutely love it. And again, the personal connection with my dad growing up in Brooklyn and being a Dodger fan and being there, being a teenager when they won the World Series in 1955, even after the Dodgers left for Los Angeles, my dad and his dad would take the train to Philadelphia to watch the Dodgers when they played the Phillies. So they did that for a few years. So I've always cherished this card, even though, and if you look at the picture of it, and I had to handle it very gingerly because it's, shall we say, a PSA 0.5. It is not in very good shape. I bought it at a garage sale many years ago for like 50 cents, I think maybe a dollar. But I had to have it because it was a 57 Topps card. It was Pee Wee Reese. It was one of my dad's favorite players from my dad's favorite team. And even though it has just been absolutely put through the ringer, I've absolutely cherished this card for the 22, 23 years that I've had it, even though it's in absolutely terrible condition. But, you know, seeing Pee Wee Reese and, you know, thinking of all the other Dodgers that I heard my dad tell so many stories about, of course, Jackie Robinson and Gil Hodges and Carl Fiorillo and Duke Snyder, who I believe was my dad's favorite player, and Roy Campanella and Don Drysdale, you know, Carl Erskine, Don Newcomb, Joe Black, you know, all these other players, Leo DeRocher, Walter Alston, Don Zimmer, you know, and we'll get to Zim in a second here, but you know, all these players that you think of, and it brought him many great memories. And I loved on like a Father's Day, the easiest gift for me to buy, especially when I was younger and didn't have a lot of money. If I could track down an old photograph of the Dodgers or an old photograph of Ebbets Field, you know, I'd put that in a frame and give it to him, and he'd cherish that, you know, showcased all around the house because it brought back so many great memories. And looking at this 57 Topps Pee Wee Reese card, card number 30, brings back a lot of great memories in that connection to the Brooklyn Dodgers and via a connection to my father. And every time I go back to New York, and I did this when he was alive too, and I'll certainly give it a little more it'll have more meaning the next time I do it. But anytime I went back to New York City on business, I would try my best to take a train out to Brooklyn and go in my dad's old neighborhood, Bay Ridge, walk the streets, walk up and down Fifth Avenue, see what's changed, see what hasn't changed. And it's amazing. There's a lot of things there that hasn't changed in 100 or so years. But being able to walk by, you know, the brownstone that he lived in with his parents and his great aunt really brings back a lot of memories. So the next time I'm in New York City, I'll definitely make that side trip to Bay Ridge and have some more memories flooding back. Now, as I mentioned, Don Zimmer. So I've got these 1960 Topps Don Zimmer, and I've always enjoyed the 1960 design. Again, you know, you can go back through our archive for the individual discussions about these particular sets. But Don Zimmer, shown here with the Los Angeles Dodgers. So it's not a Brooklyn Dodger, but it's the Los Angeles Dodgers. And reading the back of the card, I was amazed at a couple of things. First of all, the cartoon. You know, normally you have this very lighthearted cartoon on the backs of these cards. It mentions here twice in his career, Don was almost killed by a pitch. So that's pretty pleasant. But, you know, it's part of the Don Zimmer story, the fact that he was almost twice killed when getting hit by pitches and was still able to have a pretty good career as a player and certainly as a manager and later as a senior advisor. But there is a note here in the text. It says, although not a big man, Don can belt the ball a surprising distance. And it notes that he had 17 home runs in 1958. Now, part of that, too, was left field at the Coliseum, where the Dodgers played their first few seasons. It was only, I think, 265 feet down the line. Now you had 80 feet of chicken wire above it, but it wasn't all that hard to hit home runs in the Coliseum. And actually in this card, if you look very carefully in the background of the headshot of Don Zimmer, you can see the arches of the Coliseum in the background. But it, you know, it's funny to hear Don Zimmer referred to as not a big man. You have to look here, and you know, he's listed at 5'9", 177, and you look at the picture, especially the black and white quote-unquote action shot. It's not really an action shot here in Zim's case. He's just posed with a bat over his shoulder. But you forget that, yeah, Don Zimmer used to be skinny. You know, we're so used to Don Zimmer, the roly-poly manager and senior advisor, or as the spaceman Bill Lee would call him, the hamster. You know, you're so used to, you know, the big, goofy, jovial Zim, not the slim and trim Zim, if you will. But I pulled this card, again, because it's a Dodger, and yes, it was in Los Angeles, but there's a good chance that in 1960, that was the year my dad graduated from high school, there's a good chance that one summer day, my dad and his dad boarded a train, possibly from the original Penn Station, took it down to Philadelphia, got a, you know, $2 ticket at Connie Mack Stadium, or they probably would have referred to it back as Shibe Park back then with the A's already out of town and in Kansas City. But there's a chance that my dad and his dad went to the old Shibe Park, sat down and watched Don Zimmer and the L.A. Dodgers, and if you squinted, it looked like Don Zimmer and the Brooklyn Dodgers taking on the Phillies. So that was one reason why I selected this card. Now, another reason why I selected this Don Zimmer card is because Zim would be one of many former New York baseball greats to come back to New York as a member of the Mets, the 62 Mets, best remembered for being the worst team in baseball history. And again, we have these fuzzy memories of how terrible the Mets were, but how beloved they were. And it is true that they were beloved in the sense that National League Baseball was back in New York City after the Giants and Dodgers left. But at the same time, you know, laboring through a 42 and 120 win-loss record in 1962, while the Yankees are still showing up in the World Series, that had to be tough for National League Baseball fans to enjoy. And it doesn't matter how many times Marvelous Marv Thornberry runs the bases backwards in a home run. The bad outweighed the good in many ways, especially as the Mets played their first two seasons in the dilapidated Polo Grounds. And you could clearly see in 1962 why Horace Stoneham wanted to get out in 1957. So, Don Zimmer, of course, was one of the 62 Mets. And when you think of other former New York players tied into the Mets, Duke Snyder, of course, went to the Mets. You had Yogi Berra, who was a coach, of course, longtime Yankee. He ends up with the Mets. Casey Stengel, of course, the head of the Yankees for many years, the manager of so many world champion Yankees teams, first manager of the Mets. You had Gil Hodges, who eventually became the manager of the Mets. So you've got a lot of connections between the Mets and a lot of former Dodgers and, of course, former Yankees and former Giants as well. And that actually leads into the next card that I selected. And it's funny how even though this particular player, in the grand scheme of things, didn't play a whole lot into my dad's life, but it does conjure up a great story. And that is Willie Stargell, Pops, 1965, Topps, card number 377. And I pulled this card. Now, this is one I bought from the bargain bin. You know, it's a little beat up, but I paid maybe, what, $3, $5 for it. So anytime you get a 65 Topps Willie Stargell for a few bucks, well, sure, why not? But I pulled this card because my dad was at the first Mets game at Shea Stadium. So finally, New York City gets the brand new state-of-the-art stadium, Shea Stadium, located just next to the runway of LaGuardia Airport. But also it was part of the big revival of Flushing Meadows in time for the 1964 World's Fair. You know, it was a much needed breath of, renovation to the World's Fair property, which had been pretty much left untouched since the 1939 exhibition. So, Shea Stadium was truly state of the art. And not only in the sense that it was bigger, it was cleaner, it had a giant scoreboard, it had the ability to be expanded. It could have turned into one of those giant concrete donuts that all the other stadiums built in the 60s turned out to be. I think they also considered, I don't know if this was feasible, but I think they also considered putting a roof on Shea Stadium. Like I said, from an engineering standpoint, I don't know if that's possible, but I know that was discussed. But also, you know, Shea Stadium was very forward-thinking in that the lower grandstand seats mechanically moved to a different position so that you could accommodate football and baseball. The Jets played there for, from like 64 to the early 80s, 82, maybe 83, before they moved to the Meadowlands and took up residence with the Giants. But here's this brand new sparkling stadium. The Mets are still not very good, but my dad, who, in 1964, would have been finishing up his engineering degree, and somehow, some way, ended up at Shea Stadium for the season opener. It was against the Pirates. And who hit the first home run in Shea Stadium history? You guessed it. Willie Stargell of the Pittsburgh Pirates. So I look at this 65 Topps Willie Stargell card, and I smile because my dad was in the stadium during that moment and during that first game. And, you know, he was able to share that story with us. And that's one of the great things about fathers and sons in baseball is that you get so many great stories and so many things link each other to one another. So, for example, like that Pee Wee Reese card, that's a link through my dad to the Brooklyn Dodgers. Well, Willie Stargell played a key moment in the history of Shea Stadium. My dad happened to be there. Now, there's also another interesting link between my dad and Shea Stadium, and that was, ironically, through death, I saw my first major league game, regular season game, that is, at Shea Stadium. And it was in 1997. It was after my grandmother died. So my dad's mom, in all the grief and in all the paperwork and estate handling that you have to deal with after a family member's death, dad needed a release. And dad didn't just need a release, but his three sons needed a release, because as much as we enjoy going to New York City, it was still kind of a bummer. You know, my grandmother was the last of that generation of my family to pass, and she lived to be 90. It's a little bit of a bummer, and we all needed a release. So we look at the schedule, and the Mets are in town, and they're playing the Braves. Well, I didn't really like the Braves that much then. So absolutely, hey, Dad, let's go to the Mets game. So we take the subway, get off the 7 train at the Shea Stadium station. The Mets were not a very good team back then, but they were kind of on the rise. Bobby Valentine, the manager. I remember John Olerud was on that team. You know, a lot of the Mets that were part of that 99-2000 era of Mets were starting to come up through the team then. And we and 25,000 other people who had nothing better to do on a late July night in 1997 went to see the Mets and the Braves in what it was now a dilapidated Shea Stadium. We watched the jets roar over as they landed at LaGuardia Airport. And, you know, I remember the Mets beating the Braves, which in and of itself was pretty much a miracle. They beat them. I believe it was Carlos Baerga had the go-ahead home run. I want to say in the bottom of the seventh. I want to say the Mets won. I could probably look at baseballreference.com. They probably have this box score. But I want to say they won 5-2. For some reason, that stands out. And I remember after the game, standing in that subway station for an hour with 25,000 sweaty other belligerent Mets fans and having the time of my life. You know, I'd been to spring training games before. I had seen 1,000 baseball games on television, but this was my first Major League Baseball game that I was in attendance. And Dad didn't know it at the time, and I didn't know it at the time, but it was that game that brought me back into being a Major League Baseball fan. Because what happened before 1997? The 1994 strike. And I stopped watching Major League Baseball. I stopped caring about Major League Baseball. From the moment, August 12th, 1994, to that day in late July 1997, I watched only one baseball game. That was Cal Ripken playing in his 2,131st consecutive game for Baltimore, moving past Lou Gehrig's record for consecutive games played. I watched that only because as a child, I was able to track Cal Ripken's progress to attaining that record. So that was the one exception. But after that, for you know, a pretty much a good 2.5, almost 3-year stretch, I didn't care about baseball, or at least Major League Baseball. I just, so what? I just did not care. So a need for relief from the sadness of somebody passing in my family, not just for Dad, but for the kids, resulted in me being at my first Major League Baseball game, my first Major League stadium, you know, a game with my father and my two brothers. I still remember to this day, just the fun that I had. And I kind of secretly became a Mets fan for a couple of years before I moved back to Tampa. And then, you know, I wallowed in the misery of the Devil Rays as soon as I got back. But, you know, so many memories come back when I think of, you know, Shea Stadium and, you know, Willie Stargell in this case. And, you know, one other thing, my dad passed away the morning of the first game of my son's Little League tournament. His team had played very well over the past like 6 or 7 weeks. And, you know, I'm racing out to the hospital. I realize along the way, I've got my kids' equipment in my car. Oh, crap. What are we going to do? And as the day unfolded and as I had to deal with, you know, I was the first to find out my dad was going to the hospital. I was the first to find out my dad died. I was the one who had to tell my brothers my dad died. I was the first to comfort my mother. This is an emotional fire hose, all in the time span of about an hour. So I needed a release. And after informing my son that his beloved grandfather had passed away, he needed a release. So how did we deal with the grief? Through baseball, through this tournament. And, you know, the rest of the family got, you know, to the hospital and we're taking care of things. And I, you know, went back home and, you know, my son's team lost the first game of the tournament, but then they won the next 4 in a row and they actually finished in second place in the tournament, which was amazing. Not only because the team had to play, what was it? Games in 4 straight days, including a quick turnaround, a Friday night game and a Saturday morning game. So 5 games and 6 nights, and they lost to the team that on paper was by far the best. But, you know, for those 6 days, we had an incredibly fun time. It was just fun to be part of that. And it was fun to see, you know, not only my son excel, but the whole team as well. It was fun to be a coach of this particular team. And just like my dad and, you know, myself and my brothers needed that release from the sadness, and we found it at Shea Stadium in 1997, 33 years after Willie Stargell hit the first home run in Shea Stadium history, you know, we found a release in this baseball tournament. It's just so funny how baseball truly in your toughest of times becomes the opiate of the masses. It becomes your relief. It becomes that breath of fresh air that you need. Maybe it's the pace of the game. Maybe it's the simplicity of the game, but it was just such a relief, even though, like I said, we had 5 games in 6 nights and I don't know how many batches of laundry to keep our clothes clean for the next game, and the ups and downs of a baseball game and individual performances and the team performance, being able to lean on that was such a huge thing for me and my son, and ultimately for my family. Now, the next card, the stinking manager card, actually, it was gifted to me by one of the coaches on the team, Coach Mike, as we know him as, Mike McLaughlin. Al Lopez is the card here. 51 Bowman, card number 295. Al Lopez is a Tampa legend. In fact, he was the 7th of 9 children, but the 1st in the Lopez family to be born in America. The Lopez family immigrated from Cuba. His father was a cigar manufacturer. And Ybor City, which is just outside of downtown Tampa, was a big immigrant magnet in the early 20th century, mostly from Cuba, but also you had Italian immigrants especially. And he had other immigrants, but it was mostly Italian and Cuban who were the heavy influencers. So looking for a better way of life, Al Lopez's father moves to Ybor City, eventually brings the family over. And about a year after the family moves over to Ybor City, Al Lopez is born. And he and his following 2 siblings would be born in the U.S. But he was the 1st U.S. natural-born citizen in the Lopez family. He was also the 1st resident of Tampa to play in the major leagues. Great story. He was playing for the local Tampa Smokers, which was a low-level, you know, independent minor league team. And, of course, in the 1920s, you know, before Branch Rickey came up with the farm system, every minor league team would basically sell its players off to either a minor league team that was a rung up the ladder or ultimately to the major leagues. Well, Walter Johnson caught wind of how good of a player, a catcher that Al Lopez was, that it basically fast-tracked Al Lopez's career into the major leagues. So in the 1920s, he becomes a star player, later a manager, first with the Cleveland Indians, as he's pictured here, got the Indians to the 1954 World Series, where they were surprisingly swept by the New York Giants. And then in 1959, he got the Chicago White Sox to the World Series. He was a manager of the White Sox in 2 stints, late 50s and early 60s, and then again briefly in the 68 and 69 seasons. A fan favorite, but also a favorite of Bill Veeck, hence the relationship to both Cleveland and Chicago, both times when Veeck owned both teams. And Al Lopez was one of the nicest guys you'd ever meet. And that was, according to Bill Veeck, his biggest fault, which Lopez took as a compliment, by the way. But even though Lopez was criticized for some of his decisions, especially with the pitching rotation in the 1959 World Series, one of the winningest managers at the time, like I said, a big star from Tampa, but also a good focal point for anybody playing baseball in Tampa, especially with a Cuban background. So in particular, Tony La Russa and Lou Piniella. And both La Russa and Piniella had major league careers, would turn out to be incredible major league managers. And they helped lay the foundation of a very long stretch of baseball success stories that came from Tampa. And I've mentioned them before, especially from West Tampa, where Piniella and La Russa played, but also in Belmont Heights. So you had guys like Dwight Gooden and Gary Sheffield and Floyd Yeomans would come through there, Derek Bell. But also in West Tampa, you had Fred McGriff and Luis Gonzalez and Tino Martinez. So many players who made the big leagues and some Hall of Famers, including Al Lopez, to come from Tampa. And he was basically the 1st one who started it all. And you know, it still continues today. You've got a lot of Tampa natives that are making the big leagues, and you've got some stars too. You know, Pete Alonso, the latest with the Mets, former Jesuit high school ball player. You've got some Plant high school ball players who are making inroads in the major leagues, and that's very cool. Now, another reason why I selected the Sal Lopez card was not only the great history of Tampa, where I live now, but as a kid, Dad would take the free vouchers, which were on the cash register of every local Ecker drugstores, and he would bring me and my brothers to Al Lopez Field, where the Tampa Tarpons, a longtime Florida State League affiliate of the Cincinnati Reds, played. Now, the Tarpons played at Al Lopez Field from 1959 to 87. The White Sox had a team, I think they were called the Tarpons, for 1988, and then that was it. And then Al Lopez Field sat empty for 3 or 4 years, and then finally they knocked it down. And eventually, that became the site of what is now Raymond James Stadium, the home of the Buccaneers. So, for me, a lot of great memories of Al Lopez Field and the Tampa Tarpons. And in particular, I remember the drinking fountain water tasted like sulfur because they treated it with so many chemicals. You basically felt like you were drinking a bowl of scrambled eggs. It was not very pleasant. But I remember, even though Al Lopez Field in the mid-80s when we were out there, even though it was definitely showing its age, I remember the sights, the sounds, the young stars, up-and-coming stars of the Cincinnati Reds playing there. And I was very pleased to see that the Tampa Yankees, the Florida State League affiliate for the New York Yankees, who play across the street at George Steinbrenner Field, they rebranded themselves as the Tarpons prior to the 2018 season. So you better believe I'm an even bigger supporter of the Tarpons, and I've got a retro Tarpons jersey, and I love going to Tarpons games because it reminds me of Al Lopez Field and the times that I spent with my dad, my brothers as well, watching minor league baseball. And even though Al Lopez Field is no longer present, just north of Raymond James Stadium, in fact, a couple blocks north, there is a nice little park that has been called Al Lopez Park. And you got a lot of people that park there for football games or other events. So even though the stadium is long gone, there is still very much a memory of Al Lopez. And in fact, Al Lopez's childhood home, the one they lived in, I think 1913, has been since relocated and is part of the Ybor City Museum. So Al Lopez, even more than a century later, still very much a part of the Tampa baseball scene. And finally, I selected the 1972 Topps Nolan Ryan card, card number 595. Now, this is a legendary card because it features the quality airbrushing job of the Angels hat on top of Nolan Ryan's head, and he's still wearing the Mets pinstripes. Of course, Ryan traded in the 1971 offseason to the Angels, the legendary Jim Fregosi trade. And I've said before, at the time, the trade actually made sense. You know, Ryan was a very spotty, you know, a lot of potential, but injury prone, kind of got squeezed out of the rotation by John Matlack, who was an up and coming lefty. And Matlack would have a pretty good, like 10 or 11 year career with the Mets. So, you know, they certainly didn't lose out on that. But as we all know, I mean, the history of Nolan Ryan, we know what happened as soon as he ended up with the Angels. All of a sudden, he's winning 20 games. He's throwing no hitters. He's striking out over 300 batters a year. Didn't win a lot of games because besides Nolan Ryan and Frank Tanana, the Angels didn't have a whole lot in the mid-1970s. But we all know the story for Nolan Ryan from there. Now, I selected this card, and this was another bargain bin find. Let me see. I bought this for, I think, $5 at a show. And again, you know, it's a little rough. There's some minor creasing, and the corners are a little rounded. You know, this is not a card that, you know, I can go sell for $500. But, you know, for $5, again, you know, well, why not? So, you know, I picked up this card, and thought of Nolan Ryan instantly because Nolan Ryan connected me and my dad, too. My dad was very, very big in the Boy Scouts. He was, first of all, a Cub Scout. Cub Master when I was a kid, when my younger brother graduated to Boy Scouts, my dad became the scoutmaster of our Boy Scout troop. So you better believe that all three of us became Eagle Scouts because, you know, it's a blessing and a curse to have your father as the scoutmaster. It's a blessing because he would very quietly guide you to goals such as Eagle Scout. It was a curse because you couldn't take your foot off the gas. You were going to become an Eagle Scout. You were not going to be the one salmon kid who fell short of Eagle Scout status. But one thing that we did for several springs, we would go down to Port Charlotte, which is where the Rays spring train now. It's about an hour and a half, 2 hours south of Tampa. And back in the early 1990s, the Texas Rangers were the spring training residents there. And through a few phone calls and you know, a couple other connections that were made, we were able to, I think it was for three straight spring training games, three straight spring training seasons. So 91, 92, and 93, we were able to go down there and be the color guard for the baseball game. So we would go out in our uniforms with the flags and somebody would sing the national anthem and then we would march off. And then we would just be in absolute heaven because the way the ballpark was built at that time, just beyond the first base grandstand, there was an open area, just a big grassy area. And that was where the player families and friends and VIPs would stand and watch the game. And it was right by the Rangers bullpen. It was right by the Ranger clubhouse. So this was your chance to see major league ball players up close and personal. And in fact, sometimes two up close and personal. Just go back and listen to our podcast on 89 Donruss. That would have been, let me see, episode number 31 from back in the day about my run-in with a rather grumpy Kevin Brown, who was our featured player at that time. Also, if you dare, listen back to the podcast on 89 Bowman. That was episode 29. Our feature card was Jose Canseco, and I've got a great Jose Canseco spring training story to share there as well. But anyways, you know, one of the players that we were able to meet, not once, but twice, so this would have been 1991 and 92, I believe, was Nolan Ryan. And I remember Ryan pitching one of those days, and to see him pitch in person was a sight to behold, because I've always maintained that one of the big reasons why Nolan Ryan was able to dominate for as long as he did was because he used his size to his advantage. You know, he was a big, husky West Texas boy, and even at the age of, 40, 41, he could still have this hulking presence at the top of the mound that intimidated batters. You had batters getting into the box and looking at this guy. You already know he's got 300 wins. You already know he's got 5,000 strikeouts. You already know he's got 7 no-hitters. And then you're looking at him and he's just got this physical presence and you're thinking, oh crap, how am I going to hit the ball off this guy? And even if it was a 96 or 97 mile an hour fastball, which is slow by today's standards, he would still just whip it right past you. And to see that in person was so neat. But we also, both times, we were able to catch Nolan Ryan, you know, when he wasn't playing, after a workout or after he, you know, dressed down into civilian clothes, he would go over by that little VIP section and he would, for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, sign autographs. And I think I've shared this story before, but, you know, Nolan would have his head down and he would just sign one item at a time. Well, if he saw a pair of shoes that he recognized, he would look up and he would give you that Nolan Ryan stare. And the reason why he looked up is because by looking at your shoes, he knew you had cut back into line for a second autograph. And he would look up at you and say something along the lines of, "One autograph per person, please. Thank you for coming." And he would sign the second one, but you did not get back into line for a third. But, you know, that is a great memory of seeing Nolan Ryan in person and seeing all these other players too. You know, as I mentioned, Kevin Brown and Jose Canseco, but, you know, a young Ivan Rodriguez, seeing Julio Franco. Let's see, who else? Pete Encavilla was with them back then. Ruben Sierra, another one. Juan Gonzalez, a young Juan Gonzalez with that team as well. Steve Buschel, you know, one of the lesser known ones. But, you know, I remember all those players. Goose Gossage, too. You know, Goose could still zip the ball past you at an advanced age. But a lot of great memories through the Boy Scouts, which, my dad was very heavily involved right up to the day he died. And you know, being able to be in the company of those players and to be able to say, not only did I get to see Nolan Ryan in action in person, but also get to see him in person, get a couple of autographs from him. And they are still, you know, I got a couple of magazines signed by him, including one, Boys Life magazine, which is the Boy Scouts magazine. He was on the cover of Boys Life in 1990 or 91. So I got him to sign that. And that, you know, to me, that was such a big thing because as a Boy Scout and as an Eagle Scout, to see a former Boy Scout be so successful in everything he did. And of course, Nolan Ryan afterwards, being in the front office of the Texas Rangers and the Houston Astros and a Hall of Famer, you know, being able to see him in person and to interact with him and to be so close to greatness. And it's all because, you know, of a scout troop that my dad was in charge of. And, oh, by the way, Dad drove the van with us and like six other scouts down to Port Charlotte and back. That was not an easy car trip to make. You know, that's a lot of great memories just looking at, you know, even the 72 tops Nolan Ryan before he became the Nolan Ryan that we all know and love, with the exception of Mets fans. They're not so loving of him. But even though, you know, this is before the Nolan Ryan that we saw as a dominant pitcher later with the Angels and Astros and Rangers, it just looking at it brings back a lot of great memories for me. So hopefully these stories brought back some memories for you about these particular players or the teams, or perhaps some moments you've had with your dad. And if you wish to share them, please do so. Again, on our timeline, Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, I'll share some of the stories on our next podcast on June the 22nd. But, you know, it's fun, you know, and now with Dad passing, I can definitely see, you know, in some of these names and some of these players and some of these teams, there's always going to be some kind of special connection to him. And thinking of Nolan Ryan, you know, my dad was a voracious reader, and I am too. I've got a stack of books on the floor in my bedroom, and, you know, they're all queued up. So when I'm done with the one I'm reading now, the next one is on deck. But, you know, one that is, if it's not the next one, it's the one after that, is a book that my dad gave me, and it's about making Nolan Ryan. It's basically a, you know, a year by year biography of Nolan Ryan. So I'm looking forward to that book. But you know, there's a lot of great connections through the sport of baseball, through sports in general, through the baseball cards, through the stories my dad had, through the experiences I had with him. And even though Mom was very influential in me starting collecting baseball cards, as you know, Dad was very influential through many of the other steps of the way. And while there is a sadness that I can't sit down with him and talk about these players or these stories, again, it brings a smile to my face that I can look at these and I can think, you know, yeah, Dad had a part in this, or, you know, Dad told me this story about this guy or this team before. And it's stories that I share with my son now. And it's, you know, in fact, real quickly, I remember, and I think I brought this up in a podcast before, but, you know, at a local card show, a dealer gave this off-centered 61 tops Willie Mays to my son. And when I say off-center, I mean dreadfully off-center. You know, this guy was never going to be able to sell this card. So why not give it to a nine-year-old kid? And, you know, the dealer jokingly gave my son a homework assignment to tell him five things about Willie Mays. Well, my son, being obedient, actually did that, drew up some little comics about Willie Mays and gave it to the guy the next time we saw him at a show. But before we did that, you know, my son is able to share this card with my dad and my dad sharing Willie Mays stories with my son. So, you know, now when I see that ridiculously off-centered 61 Topps card, you know, I smile because, you know, it was a ball player that my dad taught me about. It was through a hobby that we both connected with, and we were both able to share the passion of to my son. And that's really what it's all about. You know, it's baseball does it better than any other sport. Baseball cards do it better than any other hobby. And that's no slight against stamp collecting or coin collecting or model car making or what have you. But there's just something very special. The bonds that are created, the stories that are told through baseball and through baseball cards. And that is one of the big reasons why I continue to do this show, why I continue to occasionally buy a box of cards or buy a pack of cards. Even though I still promise to my wife, you know, it's not going to be like it used to be. There won't be 30,000 cards here. You know, I still push off the extras as much as I can. But, you know, it's great that we're able to share the stories that my dad had and that his dad experienced with him. I've been able to share them with you. I share them with my children. And, you know, even though I'm going to miss him, it's great to be able to look at these particular items and see not just an item, but see a link to a moment in history, a link to a professional ball player or a team in history, and a link to my father. And even though my father's not here with me anymore, the memories always are. And that sounds cliche, but when you actually go through it and you live through it, you appreciate it and you realize it. But one reason why I can appreciate it and realize it and cherish it, again, there are no boxes unchecked. There are no grudges held. If your folks are still alive today, reach out to them. Pick up the phone. Give them a call. Send them an email. Just say, how are you doing? If they live nearby, go visit them. It's going to make their day. It's going to make your day too. And when the time comes for them to pass, you're not going to hold yourself back and go woulda, coulda, shoulda. And if you're somebody who can't connect with your parents because they have either passed or because there is something, like I said, you know, maybe they left you early in their lives, maybe you know, they're in prison or whatever. If you can't do it on that level, spread the cheer, the happiness, the leadership, the positive qualities of being a positive human being to other people. Be that light in a dark world. If you can't do it with your mom and dad, do it for your kids, do it for your spouse, do it for your coworkers, do it for your neighbors, do it for your friends, do it for complete strangers. Give that $5 coupon to the person behind you at the grocery line. Buy that cup of coffee for the person behind you at the Starbucks. Be kind. Be good. Spread the love. Check all the boxes. You won't regret it if you do. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic, the show dedicated to my father, Kevin Michael Salmon. Thank you so much for the memories, the great stories, and the great lessons learned that I've been able to pass on to others. Our next show, 2 weeks from today, Friday, June 22nd. I'll be in Vancouver, eh? But even though I'll be there, we'll have some cards to talk about. We'll have some great father-son stories to share, courtesy of you. And have a great Father's Day to everyone, wherever you are. We'll see you next time.